Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome you to the Supreme Court, and we will call the first case, 01-3316, in re the Marriage of Catherine Franke and Martin Franke. Mr. Jarvis, David Jarvis, is counsel for Martin T. Franke. Mr. Jarvis.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and good morning, Justices. The primary issue in this case has to do with the proper date for valuing assets in an arbitrated family law matter. The parties by contract agreed to submit their divorce case to final and binding arbitration. These arbitration proceedings were transcribed. Both sides were represented by counsel. I think there was 100 exhibits and 700 pages of transcript. The proceedings began in July of 1996 and ended on October 11, 1996. There were 7 days of hearing. After the last day of the arbitration hearing, there were several issues that still were left open, including the valuation of Mr. Franke's stock in a corporation, radio communications company. The party's home was in the process of being sold. The parties had agreed to have the 1994 and 1995 joint tax returns prepared by Mr. Franke's counsel or accountant, and there were other things to do. Throughout most of 1997, those matters got resolved, and the briefing schedule was done. There were several interim arbitration orders that were issued after that time. The arbitrator got ill in the process, and there was a delay in issuing the award. The award was not issued until April of 1998, and shortly thereafter, Ms. Jalice Franke filed a motion to confirm the arbitration award. This was done on June 9, 1998. And there things lay until April of 1999, when Mr. Franke filed a motion with the circuit court seeking a reduction in his child support. Ms. Jalice Franke responded with a motion under Section 80607 seeking relief from the judgment which had been entered on June 9 of 1998. The original trial judge, his name escapes me at the moment. I'm having one of those senior moments.
Judge Schlafer.
Thank you, Judge Leo Schlafer. Had several hearings. And he issued orders which reopened the basically the award, which was confirmed, to take another look at least three issues that are pertinent to this appeal. One was the value of Mr. Franke's stock in a company called All City Communications. Another was a $50,000 loan that Mr. Franke had made to All City Communications.
Can I just ask you, interrupt, sir, that I follow the chronological data here? As I understand it, and you can correct me, were those assets you're talking about disclosed so everyone knew about those assets at a prior time?
Yes, they were disclosed, and they were litigated in the arbitration proceeding before arbitrator Lawrence Kahn. The other issue that was revisited, in a sense, by Judge Schlafer was the ruling that the parties were jointly responsible for the taxes due on their 1995 tax returns. And in that case, Judge Schlafer, however, indicated in his decision that he didn't want to revisit that issue and he would let the award stand as to that issue. So as we're here today, let me pick up with the chronology of this rather convoluted case. Ms. Jalas-Frankie had filed additional motions seeking relief from other aspects of the award confirming, or the judgment confirming the award. And those matters were pending when Judge Schlafer retired and Patrick Farragher replaced him, Judge Patrick Farragher. What Judge Farragher did was took a look at the issue of what were Mr. Frankie's obligations to disclose assets that he had acquired after the close of the arbitration hearing on October 11, 1996, but which were in existence when the motion to confirm the arbitration award filed by Ms. Jalas-Frankie was heard by Judge Schlafer on June 9, 1998. And in that regard, Judge Farragher noted that this was a arbitration proceeding in which the arbitrator and the arbitration proceeding was the functional equivalent of a trial. He looked at two obligations, or one obligation of Mr. Frankie, as to the duty to disclose assets acquired prior to the time of the June 9, 1998 hearing to confirm the arbitration award, and looked at the statutory provision that requires that assets be updated as of the date of the hearing. And Judge Farragher addressed the question then of, well, what was the date of the hearing? Was it June 9, 1998, when the arbitration award was confirmed, or was it some other earlier date, namely October 11, 1996, which was the last date of the arbitration hearing? And that was the last date that evidence was introduced. And he concluded that in the context of these facts, that the date of the hearing was October 11, 1996. He also addressed the issue of...
Excuse me, counsel. Let me just interrupt you for a minute. We're talking about a claim...
Confusing when there are four with women's voices.
We're talking about a claim here that there were additions made to what was known by the arbitrator. Would your position be the same, and I understand you agree that the date should be the date of the arbitration hearing, not the date of the confirmation of that hearing by the court. Would your position be the same if the arbitrator had awarded a dollar amount to Mrs. Jalas-Frankie based on a valuation of stock, which after the kind of bad occurrences in our stock market would have reduced that value significantly between the time of the arbitration award and the time of the confirmation of that award, excuse me, the arbitration hearing and the time of that award. So I guess I want to know, is your position that you just can't look at those assets or valuations after that hearing, even if they diminish, or is it just when they increase?
Under all circumstances,
whether
they increase or decrease, yes, because
okay.
The arbitrator is the one who is deciding what the values of the various assets were, and the arbitrator stopped hearing evidence on October 11 of 1996.
Okay, and then my second follow-up question is it your position that this is a dispute about the valuation of assets rather than a failure to disclose assets?
I think primarily, Justice Roggensack, it is that when does the duty to disclose arise? What I've argued in the brief is that if it's at some other, you know, I'm just being cautious, you know, if it's some other date, even the evidence that was introduced on All City Communications and on the $50,000 loan were applied incorrectly by Judge Schlafer.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, how would that, so realistically, and I the reason for my first question was if there's a tremendous diminishing of the asset from the time the, you know, the arbitrator looked at the award, and here, because of the sickness and that, 18 months later, there was no asset at all, you're saying that we would just stick with the fact that the stock was worth $1 million and it's worth zero. Let's take Enron. It took about 18 months. You could have WorldCom or some of the other. Just thinking practically, how, and you're saying there's no relief from that? That's it? It would make no difference. So a person that that had that asset, you would never look at it again. It had to be that date.
I think basically that's correct. Now, I've been.
I just used the.
Yeah, I hear you. And you know, after this argument is done, my legal career is over. I am retired. So I've been around.
We hope it's not caused by this. Us.
No, Justice
Abrams.
But
we do offer our congratulations.
I got too old under my partnership agreement to continue, so.
Well, we're not going to handle whether your partnership agreement violates any laws.
This was a long way of trying to respond to Justice Wilcox's question. And what I was getting at is I've been around long enough to know that the courts can deal with, you know, extraordinary circumstances and will. But I think there's nothing extraordinary in this case. This is just a mill run case where assets were valued and I just don't think that this is that extraordinary case, which I'm not willing to close the door on every single case, Justice Abramson.
Okay. Let me see if I can understand what the issues are here. One, you don't think this judgment can be opened up under 806.07 anyway?
As to those issues that were in fact submitted to the arbitrator, that is correct.
Right. And those issues were property division?
Specifically, certain aspects, not all of property,
okay.
Certain aspects.
And?
All City Communications, the $50,000 loan, and the 1995 tax return.
Okay. What else was submitted to the arbitrator?
Oh, there were.
Maintenance?
Child support? Child support and placement issues. And my recollection, Your Honor, is that from the beginning, Ms. Jealous Frankie did not request maintenance.
Pardon?
I could be wrong on it. I don't believe there was a maintenance question submitted. It was a very short marriage, 4-year marriage, I think.
All right. But there was child support and child placement and property division, at least as to certain pieces of property, right?
That's right.
And there was a decision by the arbitrator, and there was a confirmation of that award, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the wife, former wife, is seeking to open that judgment up, right?
That's correct.
Under 806.07.
Correct.
And your position is not 806.07 cannot be used, but only chapter, the arbitration chapter. Was that 788?
Yes, chapter.
Is that right? Okay.
Or the provisions that were set forth in the arbitration agreement, which provided for appeals under chapter 808.
All of them, including child support and placement, or just the property? Because you have two separate provisions of the statute relating to the power of the judge and the responsibility of the judge to confirm awards.
One deals with property and maintenance, as I remember it. The other deals with children's issues, generally speaking.
My recollection is it says 808.01 et sec, so okay. All issues, I would think.
But the only issues here are is the property for the moment. There's child support.
Okay. There is child support, but I think the primary issue here does, I think that's correct. It's the property division.
Property is value. And with assuming, if you win on the concept that 80607 cannot be used to open up the judgment, that's the end of the case for you, isn't that right?
That's right.
If you lose on 80607, so that the award can be reviewed,
right.
Then you get into when does the duty to disclose arise? Does it come at the time of the arbitration hearing, the arbitration award, the judgment
yes.
of the court, right?
Yes.
So it's when valuation. And the third issue, as I see it, but you're supposed to tell me when I'm wrong.
Never.
Right, well, tell me when I'm slightly mistaken.
Then. Okay.
Not only when valuation, but what is the correct valuation?
That's right. That is correct.
Are there any other issues that we're supposed to be looking at in this case? I know there's an appeal and a cross appeal.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. So what's your position on 80607?
My position is that you cannot use that provision of the statutes to seek relief from a judgment confirming an arbitration award to the extent that what you're seeking to do is have the trial court revisit matters that were, in fact, submitted to the arbitrator for decision.
Well, under the arbitration provisions, you can open up an arbitration award. The judge can open up an arbitration award and needn't accept it for fraud, et cetera.
Correct.
Any of those here?
No. Not in my opinion.
If we accepted that everything is closed down at the last arbitration hearing on October 11th, 1996, what about this September 1996 balance sheet that's before October 11, 1996.
Well, there's several things on that, Justice. One is there is no evidence at all that it was in existence on October 11 of 1996. It was one of many interim balance sheets. If you wanted to take a look at what the balance sheet looks like of All City Communications on October 11 of 1996, it would be completely different than the September 30, 1996 balance sheet. Therefore, the September 30, 1996 balance sheet, which was not in existence on October 11, or there's no evidence, let me be precise, there's no evidence that it was in existence on October 11 of 1996, it would not be an accurate reflection of the value of Mr. Franke's stock in that particular asset.
Well, did Judge Schlafer reach a different conclusion, or how did he judge?
Yes, he did.
Didn't he basically conclude that there had been active non-disclosure here of that particular balance sheet?
I think it's fair to say that he must have, but he didn't say that. He must have concluded that Mr. Franke had a duty to disclose the September 30, 1996 balance sheet, and his failure to do so justified his review then of that aspect of the arbitration award. But there was, as I indicate, no evidence that that balance sheet either was in existence on October 11 of 1996, and it most certainly was not an accurate reflection of the value of the stock. We have to remember, too, that Ms. Jalas-Franke was represented by counsel during the arbitration hearing, and the value of that stock, as submitted to the arbitrator, was based on a May 31, 1996 balance sheet, interim balance sheet, and testimony. Now, It was certainly open to counsel at the arbitration hearing if he felt as though by the time we get to October 11 that the assets had changed, to make a request that the record be held open for submission of additional evidence. But nothing was done like that. Nothing was done.
Don't you think that Mr. Franke had some obligation under Chapter 767 to make a full disclosure, regardless of whether it was specifically requested on the date of that hearing?
No, I don't.
You don't think the statutes require him to do so on the record?
No, this was an individual who was in the business of buying and selling communication assets. I mean, that's what he did for a living. That was well known. It's mentioned in the arbitration award. I mean, as I indicate, I think the burden was on Ms. Jalas Franke if she felt as though the evidence that was submitted at the arbitration hearing, which was the May 31, 1996 balance sheet, might not be accurate, to do something about it. But she didn't. She was content at the arbitration hearing to rely on the evidence that was in existence.
Well, what should she have known that would make her not be content to rely on what he'd said was a correct balance sheet?
Simply a request to indicate what, you know, has anything happened since that time? Could have been a request like that. But as I explain in the brief, that the sale of this asset, which went from one of the partnerships to another one that was formed simply to buy the asset, for $240,000, which was the cash receipt shown on the 9/30/96 balance sheet. That was completely expended by October 11, 1996. So if October 11, 1996 is the date, which I think it is, all of the evidence that was introduced before Judge Schlafer indicates that the value that the arbitrator placed on Mr. Franke's stock based on the testimony in the 5/31/96 asset balance sheet was accurate as of October 11, 1996. There wasn't any contrary evidence.
Thank you.
If, hypothetically, if a party owned 100,000 shares of stock in May and it's split so that there were 200,000 shares of stock in September or before October 11th, would the owner of those shares have to report that?
Yes.
How is it different? How is that different from what Justice Rogensack asked?
Because on October 11, 1996, the value of all city communications was virtually the same as shown on the May 31, 1996 balance sheet. So therefore, I take it in your hypothetical, there would have been a big difference between the value of that asset when the arbitration hearing was closed and what was disclosed during the arbitration hearing. But that's not the case with regard to the All City stock.
Did the wife know about this $50,000 loan? Arbitrator? Did everybody know about that?
Well, yes, that was definitely discussed at the arbitration hearing,
and referred to in the
award.
Why did the trial judge think something was different then?
I don't know.
Trial court entered an order, didn't it, on that your client was to provide an updated information?
I don't remember. Judge Schlafer?
Yeah, 6998. Is that right or wrong?
No, what was in existence on 6998 was a financial disclosure statement dated 7/1/97 that said the information shown on this sheet is accurate as of 7/11/96, the first day of the hearing, plus the evidence that was adduced during the arbitration hearing.
It would be your position that the trial court would have no authority to ask that there be further information after the arbitration award, right?
That is correct.
That's right. Have to be as of that award, and then the trial court has no authority to do anything other than confirm that award under Chapter 788 or not under 788, only as to property. I'm not talking about
Yes, as to property, and as to property, which was the subject of the award.
Right.
Right.
Assume that a hypothetical client did engage in misrepresentation and fraud with regard to the evidence presented at an arbitration proceeding and benefited by that fraud or misrepresentation in the award that was granted. Is it your position that it is, if the time has run under the arbitration agreement, that it is unattackable or unassailable?
No, Justice Bradley. I think that there's a common law right. If you can't find one in the statutes, the court would find a common law right to honor the validity of its judgments that have been infected by fraud and would reopen whether under 806.07 or under a common law right to review a judgment that was procured by fraud. That's what I think the law is.
Unless the trial court had authority to review the judgment on the merits, this is property division within the arbitration agreement. Unless the trial court had authority to review that as a matter of merits, as fairness, it would make no sense to have valuation after the award.
That's correct.
So you really hinge on 806.07, so the power to do that, power to review an arbitration award that's been confirmed.
Right. Well, you have to go back. You're right, and then the subsets are what's the date of the hearing under 767,
and
what's the special circumstance under the rules that said you value as of the date of the divorce. What's the date of the divorce?
And you're saying it's the award date.
Yes. No, I'm saying
the arbitration award date.
I'm saying it's the date that the arbitration hearing was closed for the receipt of evidence.
May I? I may have missed it. What's your authority for the assertion that there's common law authority of the court to always reopen a judgment? I mean, it seems to me that 806.07 sub H might, if not A or C, you know, C being maybe the fraud, A excusable neglect or something. But you make that assertion, and I'm not familiar with that assertion. For instance, if 9 years later, some overt fraud was demonstrated. I'm just not familiar with common law authority to reopen that judgment.
There's nothing in the brief, Justice Bradley. I can tell you that I read some of those cases when I was looking at the cases under Rule 60, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I just remember it, or I think I remember it.
Well, 788.10.1a says a court can open an award where the award was procured by corruption, fraud, or undue means.
And those are, there's some time limits there.
Yeah.
90 days and then 1 year. I think that's a little confusing statute, but I think it's 1 year. And so if you had something that was beyond 1 year, I kind of think that the court has the power to do it. Maybe, you know, if you get 9 years, the court's going to say, I do have the power to do it, but I'm not going to exercise that power. It's too late.
See, I normally think that coming under statutory authority. I mean, I just don't recall reading a case, but I'll check it out. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Jones, Attorney Jones, representing Catherine Frankie.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the Court, my name is Colleen Wentworth Jones, and with me at counsel table is Attorney Roddy Willis Rogan. We represent the petitioner, respondent, cross appellant, Ms. Catherine Jalas Frankie, who I shall refer to as Ms. Frankie throughout these proceedings. We are here on primarily four issues. The first issue is a matter of first impression, whether or not Rule 80607 may be used to reopen a judgment of divorce that was entered subsequent to an arbitration award. The second issue is also an issue of first impression, and that is, was the proper date of valuation of the marital estate, be that the date of the arbitration award or the date of the divorce decree? The third issue I label as the property division. There are several issues of the property that were divided by Judge Schlafer during the reopening. Those have been appealed by the appellant, and the cross-appellant states that those were correct. A subcategory that is also the tax issue. Then the fourth issue that is before this court is also the child support issue. Now, that obviously is not an issue of first impression, but due to the grant of cert, it is here as well. I'll focus my argument on 80607. 80607 is an equitable statute. It is there for individuals who have found themselves duped, perhaps by another party, or there has been a misrepresentation that has allowed the trial court to say, no, this is incorrect, you can reopen the judgment.
In this case, Counselor, if I can just interrupt you a minute. Your opponent tells us that this is merely a valuation case. It's not a failure to disclose case. Do you agree with that?
No, Justice, I do not agree with
that.
Why
not?
I don't agree with it because of the facts that were found by the trial court. And I pulled Judge Schlafer's decision from July 27th of 2000. In there, he states, it is apparent to the court, given the totality of the record before it, that the respondent tends to minimize his ability to pay child support. He also states, it's on page 8, that given the record before it, that respondent has failed to disclose various assets, such as a failure to disclose to arbitrator Kahn the sale of the tower for $240,000. The trial court did determine that there was some sort of misrepresentation here.
Well, counsel, we asked your opposing counsel the very same question, and he said that that was all disclosed to arbitrator Kahn. In your debate,
I would dispute that. Yes,
and that's based on what the judge just said, and you just read from the record.
Yes, yes, it is based upon the record. It's based upon what Judge Schlafer stated. It's also based upon the own acknowledgement that the balance sheet that was being used by the arbitrator was a balance sheet from May of 96. The arbitration hearing of which opposing counsel speaks was in October. However, there was a September 1996 balance sheet there. Now, it's been stated that there's no evidence it was prepared as of that date. Our argument was that Mr. Franke was aware of that sale. He should have known, and he should have disclosed that. Whether or not it was shown on a balance sheet, he knew that there was not a negative equity of over $100,000 in this company, but rather that there is now a positive amount of $240,000. So to us, that would raise to a level of a misrepresentation.
Well, he says that that's your obligation also, opposing counsel, that you, in other words, when the question was asked by one of the justices, what about full disclosure? And the argument that has been made is that full disclosure is an obligation of your counsel to your client to ask for that. Otherwise, there is no obligation to make full disclosure.
I would disagree with that contention. I think under 767, there is a requirement that full disclosure be made. If a court or an arbitrator, whoever the deciding factor of fact may be, is to examine the marital estate, there must be full disclosure. Otherwise, it's a futile effort. Moreover, the arbitrator did find that that there was no lack of due diligence on the part of Ms. Franke. She and her trial counsel were very diligent in their attempts to ascertain the true value of Mr. Franke's estate, a marital estate, and what he may have added to it without her knowledge.
Let me just understand. I asked so I'm not getting the facts wrong. As I understand, this sale, this radio, this communication asset was not disclosed.
That is correct.
All right. So I'll ask opposing counsel when he comes back when it was disclosed. You're saying it was not disclosed until the further hearing by the judge?
Yes, that is what I'm saying. There was a sale of a tower for $240,000 that was not disclosed to the arbitrator. There are, because this case took so many years, there are several different assets that have come to the court's attention through the motion to reopen that sometimes get can be slightly confusing. But this particular sale was prior to the close of the arbitration.
It was prior to that date. It was not after.
That's correct.
It was prior to.
That's correct. There are later assets that were determined to have happened after the arbitration proceedings that should have been disclosed, as well as when it comes into the child support contentions, there were assets that were made available after 1998, but that's appropriate only for child support, not the property division.
Can you give me a chronological date that I could write exactly when was that disclosure? When was that sale made, rather?
Okay. I do not believe I know the actual date of the sale, Justice. I can tell you when it was learned by Ms. Franke. And the date it was done prior to. Okay. In 1999, Judge Schlafer found that there had been a sale. Furthermore, he found that there was $240,000 on the All-City Court balance sheet that should have been deemed property owned by the respondent.
Yes. Well, I realize that, but was that sale before the date that of the final hearing? In other words, that seems to be the argument. Your opposing counsel said that was disclosed to the arbitrator, and he, Mr. Kahn, knew that.
I think what the correct valuation of that would be is that there was a September 1996 balance sheet that showed the $240,000. That was not disclosed to the arbitrator. All that had been disclosed to the arbitrator was a May 96 balance sheet that actually showed a negative balance of $100,000+.
So the hearing was sometime in September 96.
That's correct.
The balance sheet for that month, which opposing counsel said there were several balance sheets, showed the sale. But the arbitrator was working off a negative figure for this asset.
That's correct.
And the award was finally made in October, right?
The award actually was not made until April of 1998.
Okay, April. And so no new testimony or evidence was put in between the hearing in 96 and the award in 98.
I would actually disagree with that.
I'm asking.
Right. the arbitrator in March of 1997 asked that Mr. Franke produce checks, show what his checks were from May to December of 1996. He also asked both parties to update their financial disclosure form as of March 15th, 1997. So there was a requirement very clearly stated by the arbitrator himself that those financials should be updated.
And that's clear, and that is from the record. That's in the record, so that if we check that we'll be able to find that, correct?
Yes, that was in one of his interim decisions. I believe it would have been the February 1997 interim order by the arbitrator informing the parties that they must update their financials as of March 15th, 1997.
I guess that's what I was driving at when I asked the question originally as far as dealing with as opposing counsel indicated, only you would look at extraordinary circumstances. Are you alleging that there were extraordinary circumstances that would allow an opening up here under 80607?
Under 80607, it can be reopened for when the motion to reopen was brought, trial counsel stated four avenues. It can be reopened under mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or exclusive neglect under sub A, under sub B, under newly discovered evidence, which entitles a party to a new trial under 805.15, under sub C, fraud, misrepresentation,
or
other
misconduct. Well, where would you characterize? What's your characterization of what we're dealing with?
I think, Your Honor, that it could be under still three of them. My primary one I would submit to the court is sub C, that there may have been fraud here or at least misrepresentation. So the arbitrator was not fully aware of what the marital assets were, and nor was the trial court, because I have to point out to the court, at that June 9th, 1998 confirmation hearing, the date on which the divorce was actually entered, the trial court did ask the parties whether or not their financials were updated as of that date. Ms. Franke said yes. Mr. Franke said, no, there are a couple little things I need to correct. He did do those corrections on the record. The trial court accepted that and then made his ruling. And in the trial court's divorce decree, he actually states that the assets of the parties, their interest thereof, varying, excuse me, the values thereof, and their encumbrances and debts are found as are set forth in the financial disclosure forms of the parties which were submitted in the arbitration proceedings and updated at the final hearing. And our position is that final hearing, the date of divorce, is the date of valuation, which is our next issue.
Well, but if you say that the trial court has the responsibility or power, whichever you prefer, to ask for an update, I have trouble to see where that is within his or her power, since 788 limits the power of the judge in confirmation to certain aspects. And I don't know that this fits in it. Maybe it does.
Our argument certainly would be that it does. And it does because they were at arbitration under 802.12. That allows for arbitration of marital property situations, of a family law case. But under that...
What does 802.12 say? Where does it give the power of the judge to not confirm an award?
Justice, what I was pointing to in terms of the 802.12 language is that it must... When an arbitration award is entered under 802.12, there are certain standards. It must comport with a property division under 767.255. And that's where I'm drawing the connection here, that if that arbitration award did not satisfy 767.255, if there was not full disclosure, then the arbitration award itself is not sufficient and should not be confirmed, so to speak. And that's why the trial court has the obligation to determine whether or not financials have been provided, whether or not this is an equitable division, before making his ruling, as he would in any other case in a family law case, be it the case there by stipulation or by mediation. When the parties come to the court goes through that exercise and determines that the parties knew what they were agreeing to, that it's fair, that there's been full disclosure, and then he enters the judgment of divorce. If at that time he learns that there has been confusion amongst the parties, then at that time it's appropriate for him to modify it as needed. In this instance, there was no knowledge at that point that there was anything wrong. The judgment was indeed confirmed. However, about 9 months later, it was learned by Ms. Franke that there were assets that had not been disclosed. And that's when she brought her motion to reopen under 806.07. And she, as any other party in divorce, should have use of that equitable argument under 806.07. When she has been duped, when there has been a misrepresentation, she ought to be allowed to come back to the trial court and say, please reopen this. There has been a misrepresentation. The award was not made with the full knowledge of myself, the arbitrator, or you, court. We need to reopen and revisit this property division.
I have problems with that. Under 3C, as to property division, it says, if the parties agree to binding arbitration, the court shall, which is generally mandatory, subject to 788, 10, and 11, and those are opening up awards, confirm the award and incorporate it, period. Under D, I'm sorry, is it E? E, in contrast, the court may not confirm the arbitrator's award under D and incorporate the award into judgment unless all the following apply. One, the arbitrator's award sets forth detailed finding of fact. Two, the arbitrator certifies all applicable statute requirements, etc. So I don't... Statute makes a distinction between property and everything else, property, attorney fees, maintenance. And it doesn't put that it has to satisfy the statute. It says it just has to come under 788, 10, and 11. In 788, 10, and 11, the time period had already expired by the time your client went in for confirmation, right?
Yes, Your Honor, under 788, the time period is the 3 months
and
to
under 3, sub 3 under 802.12, just read the language of this. Seems to me you're out of luck.
I believe that under 802.12, the court still, when it allows this to go to arbitration, this is, family law cases come to the courts. This isn't a collective bargaining agreement. This isn't any of those unique situations which are typically used for arbitration.
Agree.
But when it's a marital property case that comes before the court and they say, that's fine, we'll allow the arbitrator to make rulings, but they must go, the rulings must be made in conformity with 767.255. To me, there's an equity argument there. If the arbitrator does not have all the information before him to make a ruling on that property, then why should these parties be barred from later reopening that, where if they had gone through the mediation or if they had gone through a settlement agreement, they would be permitted to reopen this agreement, reopen the judgment of divorce?
That's right, because the legislature apparently has set forth the policy of wanting arbitration and closing this up, at least as to property.
Your Honor,
and if you look at the Judicial Council note for subsection 3, it states that as to custody, placement, visitation, and support, it's a special rule. It doesn't say there's a special rule as to property.
You're right, Your Honor. The statute does not state that there's a special rule there. However, since 80607 is an equitable method of approaching these, and that is my theme, it's equity here, that we should be permitted to do this. And the reason being that the courts have found, if you look at Lukowski, that in terms of utilizing 80607, it's not merely for perverse misconstruction or positive misconduct plainly established, or if there's a manifest disregard of the law, or the award itself is illegal or violates strong public policy, but also if the proceedings are infected by the infirmities set out in 788.10 or 788.11. I think that disjunctive language here should give this Court guidance that using 80607 is not prohibited by 788. 80607 has its utility, as does 788. But 788 is primarily used in situations for collective bargaining agreements or insurance contracts where there is a contract to be interpreted by that arbitrator. Whereas here, the arbitrator is getting its authority from the courts to visit an issue for family law.
Now, there is an arbitration agreement in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Pardon me? It is, and it's in the appendix here. And that arbitration agreement has essentially two provisions. One is that on trial court review, it's limited to 788, 11, and 12. But on appellate review, it's not limited in that manner. Appellate review appears, at least from my quick reading of this arbitration agreement, appellate review seems to be appellate review of a judgment rather than the fact that the judgment is based on an arbitration award. So the parties thought that through. The general rule in arbitration is you're bound by the agreement because you can have a different arbitration agreement depending on what you want to do. And so why shouldn't we hold the parties' feet to the fire?
I don't believe it's appropriate here. I certainly agree that that's what is in the arbitration agreement, that the circuit court has continuing jurisdiction over the matter in regards to child support or in regards to maintenance. The arbitration agreement goes on to state that the parties may seek appellate review of the arbitration award pursuant to 808, and that, I believe, is what, Chief Justice, right, you were just pointing to. But in that following sentence, it also says, appellate review of the award shall not be limited to the grounds set forth in 788.10 and 788.11, but may be had as if it were a judgment.
That's appellate review.
That is appellate review. I think, however, that goes back to the fact that there's going to be a judgment in the circuit court when we have a divorce proceeding. I think this is unique. This is a matter of first impression to the court. Our position is, though, since it is a family law case where those decisions are being rendered by an arbitrator and it comes back to the family law court, that equity allows an escape route for individuals who have been, I keep using this word duped, and I apologize for not using a better word, but for individuals where a property division has been rendered based upon perhaps a misrepresentation, or even if it goes so far to as fraud, these individuals should have a safety net here, which is 80607.
Let me interrupt for a minute. Was any effort made to use 788.11 modification of award?
No.
Did it go back to the arbitrator at all here?
No, Justice.
Why not?
They did not go back to arbitrator. I personally was not involved at that stage. They did not go back to the arbitrator, as I understand it. At the time, they didn't know that anything had gone awry. Arbitrator's award came down in April of 98. It was moved to be confirmed in May, or excuse me, the confirmation hearing was in June 9th of 1998. In that limited time, nothing came to light that there had been any sort of misrepresentation or that the parties weren't fully aware of the facts. So it was confirmed. And that's actually another point where I believe that once it's confirmed, we're outside of 788. We're now dealing with a final judgment or order of the court. And I think that 80607 speaks specifically to that. When you have a final judgment or order of the court, that's when 80607 may be used. Now, frequently in arbitration proceedings.
I've got another question before you go any further.
Yes, of course.
You indicated before that in March of 1997, the arbitrator asked for updated financial information. Was that provided by both sides?
My recollection as to that fact was that financial forms were provided. However, if I recall correctly, the financial form that was provided by Mr. Franke at the bottom had a caveat in it that simply stated these forms are updated as of October 11, 1996, except for those facts adduced at subsequent hearings. So he didn't disclose information, but if it had been revealed during the subsequent hearings, it was incorporated therein.
Did he, when he did this updating, disclose the loan, disclose the sale? Were those items disclosed in this updated information?
I can tell you for sure that the sale was not disclosed. As to the loan, I do not believe that it was. I think there was confusion on the arbitrator's part based on our contention is by a lack of disclosure as to what that $50,000 loan was. It was actually a loan from Mr. Franke to one of his companies, which is to say that he is owed $50,000, $50,000 from the marital estate. Therefore, Ms. Franke's 50% of that is $25,000. And that's what Judge Schlafer found, that she should receive an additional $25,000 from that loan.
Counsel, how does this fit in? As a former trial court judge handling divorce cases, I believe the court has an independent duty, because it is the court, with regard to child support, with regard to custody, and with regard to property division. You could easily, and I had many cases, you know, let's say the situation, maybe the woman had an affair, and guilt was written all over her. And so she comes into court, she signed a stipulation, the parties have signed it, that says, I get nothing, and exaggeration for emphasis, he gets $900,000. And of course, regardless of what the agreement is, and the agreement could even say, I'm putting in my hypothetical, we shall be bound by this agreement regardless of what the court says. I think the court has an independent duty to make sure that the property division is fair and equitable, regardless of the agreement of the parties. How, number one, what authority do you have for my premise? I have some authority, but what authority do you have for my premise? And how does that premise relate to arbitration agreements?
In terms of the authority that you have for that premise, if you look at Conrad versus Conrad, a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, there is a statement in that case that says, when a court follows and adopts an argument of the parties, making it a part of its judgment, the court does so on its own responsibility, and the provisions become its own judgment. So I think that speaks to your comment that when you as a judge look at, be it a stipulation, as you said in your hypothetical, you still have a duty to weigh the equities and look at 767 and apply it to the stipulation before entering it as your judgment.
And under the statute, 767.255 sub L, the court has an
the court will not find binding the terms of an agreement that the court determines to be inequitable as to either party. I guess maybe there's statutory authority that the court has to go behind in divorce actions any agreement. I shouldn't say any agreement, agreement in terms of stipulation of the parties in order to put its imprimatur of equity, regardless of the terms.
Absolutely, Justice Bradley.
Well, how does that play at all with not just the good old garden variety stipulation? This doesn't talk about stipulation. I guess sub L talks about an agreement. How does the agreement referred to in sub L of 767-255 differ, if at all, from the arbitration agreement entered by the parties?
Justice Bradley, my time is up. Would you like me to try and answer that? I think that they need to be read together. And I think that's where I was trying to point to Chief Justice Abrahamson when I was looking at 802.12, that there's a property division that's looking at 767. 255, that the court must determine that this is a fair and equitable division of the property, that those are read into arbitration agreements, any statutory authority that the arbitrator may have to rule upon a family law case in this situation, so that the equity of 806.07 is applicable here, where 767.255 has not had its full application in the arbitration proceeding. And the judge, in this case himself, was not aware either and went ahead and confirmed the award, even though having asked whether or not the financials were updated. And then it's later learned by a party.
Thank you.
Of course, 800 section dealing with 802.12 was adopted effective July 1, 1994. After these other statutes.
Okay. Thank you very much,
Chief
Justice.
Before you leave, I have to keep you just 1 minute more. There is another statute that we haven't talked about. It's 788.14 sub 3. And that statute is of interest to me because it says the judgment so entered, being a judgment entered on arbitration, shall have the same force and effect in all respects as and be subject to all the provisions of law relating to a judgment in an action, and it may be enforced as if it had been rendered in an action in court in which it was entered. Does that section have any bearing on your arguments that we should treat this judgment the same way as we would if there hadn't been arbitration, or is it just not relevant to this controversy?
No, yes, I think it does actually have a very strong bearing on this case because, as I alluded to before, many times proceedings that go through arbitration are collective bargaining agreements, something of that nature. But here it's an agreement that does have to be confirmed with the court. In order for a divorce decree to become effective, there must be an order by the court. Therefore, once there is an order by the court, I believe then you can apply 806.07 to reopen that order.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jarvis, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and then Ms. Jones, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel?
Thank you, Justice Abrahamson. I want to make one thing clear. I certainly did not mean to say that the $240,000 sale, which I don't think the record indicates when that occurred, but it seems to have occurred in September of 1996, was disclosed. I don't think I said that. If I did, I made a mistake. What I said was that was a transaction in which Mr. Franke and his partners formed another corporation called Wisconsin Tower Partners. It borrowed $240,000 from a bank, gave the $240,000 to their other company, All City, which then, by October 11 of 96, had completely paid out that money, paid off debt of All City. And Wisconsin Tower Partners, which was disclosed, and I'll come to the financial disclosure statement issued next, had the debt. So there was no additional value to Mr. Franke's total assets if you look at Wisconsin Tower Partners and All City together. But the $240,000 sale was not disclosed to the arbitrator as such. Now,
well, what was the judge talking about then when he allowed this to be reopened and said that this was not disclosed?
A subpoena had been issued to a bank in Fond du Lac. And I forgot the details, but among the documents that were disclosed was a 9/30/96 balance sheet for All City Communications, which was in the bank file. And so that's what led. Then we went off on this chase about, you should have disclosed that. That's how that came about. The interim order, number one, dated the 4th of February, 96, says in Appendix 108, it's paragraph 13, on or before March 15, 1997, each party is to present to the arbitrator and opposing counsel an updated financial declaration in the standard form. Now, I think counsel misspoke when she said that the parties were ordered to give financial disclosure statements that reflected assets as of March 15, 1997. That is not what that order said. The order said give us an updated financial disclosure statement by March 15, 1997. And Mr. Franke's update, you have to remember there were numerous proceedings, including in the family court, before the arbitration agreement occurred. There were several earlier versions of financial disclosure statements. This case, Charles Dickens would have loved this one. I mean, it has a 92 FA number on it.
Yeah, I know. Counsel, if I may, so, I want to get back to the trial court's responsibility in a divorce case, perhaps different than an insurance or collective bargaining based on arbitration. Perhaps not, and that's what I want to explore with you. Is it your position that an arbitration agreement, an award entered in a divorce action is not subject on property division, is not subject to the circuit court's duty to assess whether or not it's equitable?
Yes, I think so. Yes, it is.
So, in other words, it escapes or it is contrary to, that's not the right word. Although the court has a duty to review a property division agreement entered into by the parties to determine whether or not it is equitable, if this agreement is one that has gone the arbitration right, it relieves the court of any responsibility from making an independent assessment as to the whether or not it is equitable.
That's exactly right, because that's what the parties wanted. The parties contracted to have an arbitrator do what a court would do.
Well, what if the parties said, look, child custody is a real pain. You know, it destroys the family. We are going to agree. We're going to put this to arbitration. It takes us 2 years to get on the court calendar. We've got an arbitrator that can do it in 90 days and won't get ill. And it will have a decision, and that will be good for everyone. So we are going to agree that whatever the arbitrator decides on custody, we will be bound to it, and it is not reviewable, even though the court under the statute has a duty to make sure it's in the best interest of the child. We are going to relieve by this agreement the court of its duty to determine best interest of the child. Would that be an enforceable contract?
I don't think so. I think 802.12 sub 3 sub something says no.
And if the statute can be read to say, with regard to property division, a court has a duty to determine whether or not the property division is equitable. Can the parties contract to relieve the court of that statutory responsibility? If that's the way the statute is read.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want you to. I don't think that's the way that reads. But if it did, I don't know, Justice Bradley. There's a compelling interest in making sure that children are cared for. That may not exist. I don't think it does exist when we're talking about money and property. I think the parties could contract out of a judicial review of the merits of a property division, if that's what they did, if there were a statute that said the court has an independent. I don't know. That's just, I just don't think you can tell a trial judge that. You can't look
can't
at
either.
This. I was
good luck,
uniformly unsuccessful in doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Jarvis.
Counselor, I have one question.
All right.
Yes.
We have, you know, marriage in Wisconsin is statutory. We don't have common law marriage.
Between husband and wife.
Yeah, well, marriage is statutory, as I repeat, in Wisconsin.
All right.
If, in fact, I buy your argument, aren't I permitting a divorce by contract? In other words, saying, well, the parties agreed to arbitration, so if things didn't go well in arbitration and there were not the disclosures that the court might have required in a regular divorce proceeding, that's what they agreed to. And can we as a court really say, well, we don't have, you know, we have only statutory marriage, but by divorce we can have divorce by contract. This is how you agreed to be divorced, or does that get in the way of what the legislature decided we have in Wisconsin?
I think the divorce is the dissolution of the bonds of matrimony, and that was done on June 9, 1998. The arbitrator did not do that. The arbitrator simply divvied up the property.
Okay, so you don't see the accoutrements that go with that dissolution or that change in status. You see that as being a separate parcel, so the parties can contract separately.
I do, Justice, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jarvis. Ms. Jones? Need a green light here.
Well, I'm going to ask a question.
Regardless of the lights.
I don't care what the
right.
Light says. You have Chapter 788 on arbitration, and you have 806.07. And there's a relationship between those two. Is the relationship exactly the same in cases not involving family law and marriage as it is with those cases?
Our contention is that there's going to be a differentiation here. That differentiation being because the arbitrator is reviewing a family law matter. He has to, by virtue of that fact, interpret 767, whereas the cases in which you are referencing are primarily commercial arbitration agreements, be they from the collective bargaining agreement, from an insurance contract. It's a situation in which an arbitrator is chosen or a panel is decided upon for a specific issue of determining the contract language. Here there's no contract to determine or to rule upon, but rather the dissolution of the marriage, which the arbitrator himself cannot do, but the division of the property, the division how child support is going to be set up, whether or not there be maintenance. Those are determinations.
Well, let me ask this. In something other than a family law case, is it all right for one of the parties not to disclose all of the facts or even to mislead the other party or mislead the arbitrator?
No, I do not believe that is okay. You have to look to the arbitration agreement in each case. However, I think that 806.07 would be available to those parties as well if they could show something comparable in terms of misrepresentation. My problem with that is that oftentimes in those arbitration agreements, it sets forth that they are only interpreting the collective bargaining agreement, in which it is quite clear, here is XYZ. If there's a termination, such and such happens, that sort of thing. It's an interpretation of a contract, so it's going to be a much rarer situation, I would propose to the court, where something in a commercial context would have the need to utilize 806.07, because 788 will allow them to vacate if they know something was awry, if they know that the other party did not do what they're supposed to do pursuant to that contract. Whereas here, when the court must look at property division and look at the marital estate, they have to make a weighing of the equities for those parties. I mean, the court must determine whether or not this division of property is fair. And that determination cannot be made if there's not full disclosure, which is why we would contend that 80607 is available to the parties after the confirmation of the arbitrator's award and the judgment of divorce is entered, that the parties can then utilize 80607 to reopen that. And when I pointed to Lukowski earlier, there's that disjunctive language that you're not limited to 788 when you're trying to review an arbitration award. The other cases that have been reviewed by this Court and the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin dealing with marital cases and the reopening of a judgment have determined that it is appropriate in situations where there has been some form of misrepresentation or the parties didn't understand their stipulation. In Conrad, we have a situation where the wife was not understanding what the stipulation itself was. The court determined, yes, it is appropriate to reopen. We also have cases that can be contrasted with our case where the parties are simply asking the court for another opportunity. They're not pleased with it. There isn't a claim of misrepresentation or not one that's sufficient to reopen under 80607. 80607 is not always going to be available to reopen. The parties do have a burden of showing to the court that there has been a misrepresentation and that there is then cause for the court to reopen. It's not automatic. There must then be that next.
The circuit court in that regard did not enter into any findings that would ordinarily be a part of the record, a necessary part of the record in any litigation on an 80607 motion. Neither of the orders did.
I'm sorry, I was speaking of Conrad.
I'm referring to the procedure that was followed in this case.
Okay, I'm sorry, yes.
And you're claiming that the authority to reopen the judgment that was entered after the arbitration order was confirmed or the arbitration award was confirmed exists in 80607. But the trial court didn't enter into any 80607 findings, as would ordinarily be the case, right?
I just
went ahead and revisited the issue as if it were a garden variety divorce, a revisitation of a marital settlement agreement, for example.
I'm sorry, my time is up. Should I?
You should respond.
Okay,
please.
Thank you. I want to make sure that I'm understanding the question correctly. As I understand it, in this situation, the trial court had before it, it had entered the divorce judgment. Later, Ms. Frankie came and said, move to reopen, due upon assets she learned had not been disclosed. And then at that stage, the court said, I am going to have a hearing on that matter and determine whether or not there is an adequate finding under 80607 that there was misrepresentation and that it would therefore be just for me to reopen it. That
the court didn't make those findings, did it?
I believe that it did. When I look at its July 7th, its July 27th, 2000 hearing, it appears as though it did. And even prior to that, in 1999, when it was first determining whether or not to take this next step, let me refer to my notes.
What are we talking about, the first or second?
I'm sorry, Chief Justice, I didn't hear.
Which trial court are you talking about, the first or the second?
I'm sorry. I'm talking about the first trial court, okay. Judge Schlafer, when I'm talking about 1999. In 1999, the trial court entered findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order based upon Ms. Frankie's 80607 motion to reopen, stating that the $240,000 found in the All City Corporation balance sheet shall be deemed property owned by the respondent or through his corporation for purposes of property division. He found that it existed, therefore went through and had additional hearings to determine whether or not it would then be just for it to be reopened and a new judgment entered.
I don't read that as an 80607 finding. The way that I'm accustomed to 80607 motions being litigated, that the moving party has an obligation to show that one of these subsections applies and the circuit court finds one of the subsections applicable. He didn't say in any of these orders, as I read the record, that there is grounds to reopen the judgment or grant relief from the judgment or order because of mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect, newly discovered evidence, fraud, misrepresentation, or other misconduct. He just plowed ahead and revisited the marital property settlement without entering into any of those findings that there were grounds actually under the statute to reopen the judgment.
And I don't want to waste the court's time by flipping through my notes. If I recall correctly, however, he did make a ruling that it was proper to reopen under 80607. I think he did rely heavily upon Ms. Frankie's counsel's brief that set forth these allegations. He said, based upon these allegations, there is now a question whether or not there might have been misrepresentation, that sort of thing. He then went on to have hearings in which he determined that there indeed was this misrepresentation, which is why the judgment of divorce was then reentered.
Thank you, counsel. If there are no further questions, we will conclude our hearing in this case. And I want to thank Mr. Jarvis and Ms. Jones for arguing this case, and our best wishes to Mr. Jarvis on his retirement. And I assume Ms. Jones is continuing in the practice of law. That closes the case 013316 in remarriage of Catherine Frankie versus Martin Frankie.